Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to review new evidence that water fluoridation does not prevent cavities. Who says this? Harvard University. Turmeric neutralizes deadly viral infections. Radishes are linked to healthier cardiovascular and urinary tract benefits. And glyphosate could be the largest risk factor for celiac disease. Who says this? MIT. And a lot more on health and healing. Also today, we're going to talk about Big Pharma promises men endless youth with drugs that may cause blood clots and heart problems and suicide. Martha Rosenberg from Alternet. This is a continuation of my discussion yesterday. Also today, antidepressants may be worsening depression, not treating it. And something that you have not heard before, and it's an exclusive today, the CDC made two changes to how polio was diagnosed, and instantly 30,000 people disappeared. 30,000 people. Now, plus, the media is misrepresenting the facts about this measles death, the first death since 2003. So we'll deal with that. And my guest in the second part of our program is Ray McGovern, and we're going to talk about NATO, European Union, the United States versus Greece, and the Greek austerity program. So that's what we're dealing with. Let's begin. Most people don't think about radishes. They just sometimes have them, more often than not, as a garnish. In point of fact, radishes are extremely beneficial. According to the latest news, radishes can help on several different levels. They're loaded with what are called anthocyanins. That's a type of flavonoid. And they get their bright red color and multiple health benefits from these flavonoids. And these flavonoids, in multiple studies, can reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease. They have anti-cancer properties and anti-inflammatory properties. And another reason radishes are a great vegetable for keeping cardiovascular disease at bay is their high vitamin C content. And we know that vitamin C can boost cardiovascular health by keeping blood cholesterol levels down and blood pressure down. But vitamin C also assists in producing protein collagen, which keeps blood vessel walls strong and healthy and keeps your skin tighter. It also, with radishes, if you were to throw, let's say, two or three radishes into a glass of juice them as well, you would have a natural diuretic. And as a diuretic, it helps release the water that's frequently in your ankles or feet. So that's very good. Plus, it helps kill bacteria that creates that burning sensation in your urinary tract or bladder. So it's great for the bladder. And it also is rich in potassium, which can help reduce blood pressure and help your heart. And remember, when you have adequate potassium, it also helps your arterial supply. It relaxes blood vessels, which increases blood flow, which then reduces the blood pressure since the blood does not have to push itself through the stiff and narrowed vessels. And it's good for increasing circulation in the brain. Just some of the reasons why little tiny radishes are so good for you. Now, something is not good for us and should have been banned a long time ago and would have been if we lived in a society that cared about people's health instead of the money that goes to individual politicians is glyphosate, Roundup. Here's the latest from MIT. It could be the largest risk factor for celiac disease. Now, just so everyone knows, celiac, also known as gluten intolerance, is increasing in prevalence in the United States and Europe. A study by the Interdisciplinary Toxicology Group estimates that about 5% of the American population suffer from it. And gluten intolerance can cause a lot of problems, diarrhea, anemia, nausea, even depression. And if it goes untreated, it can get worse. And I've seen problems with that are so severe that there's thyroid issues, inflammation throughout the bowel. And generally, wheat, rye, and barley, which are the main sources of dietary gluten, are consumed for a long time. But I have found that putting people on a gluten-free program for a month, you start to see mucus clear up in their throat, in their eyes, in their mouth. You start to see candida clear up, digestion improve, gastric reflux reduced. Now, here's the issue, and this is what makes this different and unique. Professor Stephanie Seneff, a senior research scientist at MIT, had this research that she believes that glyphosate is the main ingredient in the chemical weed killer known as Roundup, and Roundup sticks to the wheat that it's sprayed on, even though the process of turning it into flour and other food items, and no one washes it off. And of course, chemical companies want us to believe that this is all nonsense. There's nothing to worry about with all these chemicals. Well, we got 80,000 of these chemicals. None of them, not one of them, is important for our biochemistry, or even our biochemistry knows how to deal with it. And fish have been exposed to Roundup, show the same signs and symptoms of glyphosate toxicity as humans. They develop digestive problems and imbalances in the flora of their digestive tract. In addition, they develop vitamin deficiencies as well as deficiencies in some minerals. And now as Roundup chelates them out of the body. These are all identical to symptoms humans with celiac disease can experience. And some experts suggest that we should get off all wheat, and I suggest we give up all glyphosate and these other toxic herbicides. Simply don't use them. It's that simple. Now, turmeric is what creates that yellow color in your curry. Most Americans never use curry, and those who do generally don't get a whole lot of turmeric in it. But it's not really the turmeric itself. It's its most powerful component, which is curcumin. So curcumin is what really is beneficial. And when I say beneficial, we're talking about a wide spectrum of benefit. Now, according to Sayer G of GreenMed Info, in a peer-reviewed journal called In Vivo, an article entitled Curcumin Suppression of Cytokine Release and Cytokine Storm, a Potential Therapy for Patients with Ebola and Other Severe Viral Infections. In lay language, what that means is that right now there are hundreds of millions of dollars being spent looking for ways to treat Ebola, to come up with a vaccine or a drug. But think of all the viruses that people are supposed to live with, like hepatitis B and C, that can kill you and do thousands per year. And herpes, hepatitis is a killer. Herpes is not a killer per se, but herpes 6 can really destroy your immune system. Coxsackie virus, adenoviruses. So here's what this means. That turmeric is about 3 to 5% curcumin in dry weight. It's one of the most extensively studied substances on the planet. There are over 1,540 studies from independent quality journals on turmeric and its therapeutic value. And it impacts 600 conditions, and it can ameliorate hundreds of causes of physical suffering. Now, let's just focus for a moment on Ebola. The terminal stage of Ebola and other viral diseases is often the onset of a cytokine storm, meaning the massive overproduction of cytokines, cyto, C-Y-T-O, kines, K-I-N-E-S. And that destroys our immune system. So in this study, they used curcumin and found it suppressed this cytokine storm. And by blocking this, it had anti-inflammatory properties, and it allowed the immune system to fight the disease. The conclusion, quote, this is from the study, the use of curcumin should be investigated in patients with boli and cytokine storm. Intravenous formulations may allow achievement of therapeutic blood levels of curcumin. Okay. I have a better way, a way that's been used for a long time, especially with people with hepatitis B and C, HIV infection. Have them take curcumin as a curcuminoid in a tablet, about 7 to 10,000 milligrams a day. That is more than what you would get if you used it intravenous, and a lot less expensive. And it would help people with all types of viruses. I remember when I did my first debate on fluoride, and it was 1972, and I'd written an article about why it was dangerous at one part per million, the amount you would get in a glass of water, and that there were questions, did it really prevent tooth decay? And everyone said, of course it does. But now that's being questioned. Let me quote verbatim from Harvard University. Quote, this week, a new and highly needed scientific review has found that there is no real evidence. Let me repeat that. There is no real evidence linking water fluoridation with cavity prevention, further proving that the IQ-damaging substance known as sodium fluoride truly does not have a place in our water supply. It was back in 2012 that I shared with you results from a major Harvard study that revealed the dark relationship between IQ levels and sodium fluoride consumption. Specifically, the Harvard researchers detailed the fact that children who lived in areas with high sodium fluoride content had, quote, significantly lower IQ than those in areas with less added fluoride content. What's more, this research was published in a federal government medical journal known as Environmental Health Perspectives. The researchers from Harvard specifically stated, quote, the children in high fluoride areas had significantly lower IQ than those who lived in low fluoride areas, end quote. Remember, this was back in 2012. So why has almost nothing changed? Now, a particular valid question noted back in 2011, the government actually called for lower fluoride levels amid a growing body of research that it was negatively affecting the health of Americans. Fast forward to April 2015, and finally the federal government decides to lower fluoride levels for the first time in 50 years, a monumental event in the history of water fluoridation and public health. Now, here we are, and here's what the latest is. This is a landmark study hit, quote, sodium fluoride in the water supply isn't even preventing cavities. Now's the time to make this a well-known study instead of a footnote buried within the latest news feed. After all, this huge news that this information is finally being displayed by mainstream media after years of anti-fluoride activists enduring the label of conspiracy theorist. So, and by the way, you can look at the piece by Newsweek entitled Fluoridation May Not Prevent Cavities. Scientific review shows, quote, the review identified only three studies since 1975 of sufficient quality to be included that addressed the effectiveness of fluoridation on tooth decay in the population at large. These papers determine that fluoridation does not reduce cavities to a statistically significant degree in permanent teeth. That's according to the co-author Anne Marie Glennie, health science researcher, Manchester University in the United Kingdom. So, that's that. So, we were right. Your dentist, the medical community, the scientific community was wrong. And if you want to get an update on all that's wrong with fluoride and the whole history of it, read the fluoride fiasco. I've been updating this all the time for over 30 years. And finally, flavonoid-rich diet can reduce the risk of diabetes. This is really good news because it's a major study, and here's what it says from Natural News. Quote, anyone who reads the paper, keeps up with the news, has probably heard about what medical experts are dubbing the epidemic of diabetes in the United States alone. There are about 30 million diabetics, and about 7 million of those are undiagnosed. Diabetes can hit women particularly hard due to the fact that it can affect not only their health, but the health of their unborn children. Diabetic moms are at risk for many problems with their pregnancies, including premature birth, complicated deliveries, and even miscarriages. However, the good news is that there are many lifestyle choices women can make to help protect against developing diabetes. Maintaining normal body weight, exercising regularly, and controlling stress are all good examples. Also helpful is a diet rich in the compound called bioflavonoids, which recent research has linked to a decreased chance of developing diabetes. By the way, this audience knows that bioflavonoids are an antioxidant. It's an umbrella term for a compound which is able to protect the body's cells against oxidation, a process which is caused by the presence of free radicals from smoking, drinking. Alcohol is really bad for it, caffeine, and lots of other chemicals, and it increases the aging process. So the bioflavonoids found in your fruits and vegetables and dark chocolate and green teas, they can grab these free radicals, neutralize them. And in a study in the United Kingdom, the women age 18 to 76 were selected to participate, and they gave their medical history and all, and then they started to see what happens when they eat bioflavonoid-rich foods. Big improvement in blood sugar and diabetes, and therefore you're protecting yourself against heart attack as well. That's the latest on health and healing. Now, for a few other issues involving people's health, I want to share something about antidepressants can actually worsen depression, and worsening it by not better than not treating it. This is from Julie Fidler from Natural Society. Quote, for years we've been told that depression is caused by low serotonin levels in the brain. Now a leading professor of psychiatry is warning that belief is little more than a dangerous miscommunication, saying the marketing of selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs, quote, is based on a myth, end quote. Now, the SSRIs began to skyrocket in use in the early 1990s. The drugs were seen as a safer alternative to tranquilizers, which were the standard treatment for depression until that time. Now, despite being weaker than old-style tricyclic antidepressants, they grew in popularity because it was believed they restored serotonin levels back to normal. Quote, a notion that later transmuted into the idea that they remedied a chemical imbalance, end quote. And that's according to Professor David Healy, head of psychiatry at Hergest Psychiatric Unit in North Wales. So he wrote a report on this, and it was published in the Journal of the British Medical Journal. And no one knew if the SSRIs raised or lowered serum levels of serotonin. There was no evidence that the treatment worked at all. The drugs had fewer side effects than their predecessors, but did that mean that they worked? Quote, for doctors, it provided an easy shorthand for communication with patients. For patients, the idea of correcting an abnormally imbalanced brain has a moral force that can be expected to overcome the scruples some might have had about taking a tranquilizer, especially when packaged in the appealing form that distress is not a weakness. So, top mental health professionals have always known that depression might not be caused by serotonin levels alone, but the public never got the memo. A professor, Sir Simon Weasley, president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists and considered the most important psychiatrist in the United Kingdom, quote, most researchers have long since moved on from the old serotonin model, Really? Well, I'm working on a documentary right now called Manufacturing Madness, and 12 out of 12 of the top most popular board-certified psychiatrists in America each told a completely normal, healthy woman that was sent in within 2.5 to 7 minutes that she suffered from a brain chemical imbalance for depression and was given different drugs. They obviously didn't get the memo. Quote, Professor David Taylor, Director of Pharmacy and Pathology and Head of Pharmacological Sciences Clinical Academic Group, King's Health Partners, said this, Professor Healy makes a forceful but poorly supported argument against something which doesn't and has never really existed, the idea that the SSRIs correct an imbalance of serotonin in the brain. Researchers and psychiatrists alike know that the SSRIs are effective in a number of disorders, but no one is sure how they work. So then no one's ever proven that there is a chemical imbalance in the brain. Correct. So there's no studies. There's no therapeutic test. There's no X-ray, MRI. There's no chemical blood or diagnostic tool to show that you have a chemical imbalance in your brain. Correct. So virtually the entire field, 100% of the field of psychiatry that has been using the will correct your brain and chemical imbalance are wrong. Yeah. So the entire field of psychiatry, with the exception of those that might use talk therapy, are engaged in deception with deadly results. Yeah. And all these soldiers coming through one of the most despicable agencies of government, well, I should retract that. They're all despicable. But let's just say the Department of Veterans Affairs, they've been giving all these vets in Iraq and everywhere else these selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs, and the side effects include suicide, agitation, homicidal tendencies. Yes. So when they come back to the United States and they take a gun and kill themselves, 23 to 24 a day, no one finds that unusual. No. And when they kill other people, it's about the gun, not the fact they were on meds. Yeah, that's it. Remember, medicines cause people who have guns to kill people. Why don't we have that discussion? Because it wouldn't be politically convenient for those people who believe that it's just the guns. Why don't we look at why psychiatry is a complete fraud and has caused teenagers to be diagnosed with conditions they don't have and put on drugs, and that now the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. And those kids, more often than not, are on their drugs. It would be an inconvenience and embarrassment. How would it look? And what would happen to the pharmaceutical companies who are paying the drugs for the drugs to be advertised in all these prestigious journals and putting on all these continuing education conferences that all these doctors go to and all the money that's made? Do you think anyone is going to want to give up that money? Do you think 60 Minutes would give it up? Do you think NPR or anyone else that's get grants would give it up and be objective? No. Of course not. Quote, Marcia Angell, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, explained in a New York Times book review exactly how this theory was set about. Quote, when it was found that psychoactive drugs affect neurotransmitter levels in the brain, as evidenced mainly by the levels of their breakdown products in the spinal fluid, the theory arose that the cause of mental illness is an abnormality in the brain's concentration of these chemicals that is specifically countered by the appropriate drug. That was a great leap of logic. It was entirely possible that drugs that affected neurotransmitter levels could relieve symptoms when, even if neurotransmitters had nothing to do with the illness in the first place, and even possible that they relieve symptoms through some other mode of action entirely, end quote. So with this logic, Angell writes, quote, you could argue that fevers are caused by too little aspirin, end quote. Healy warns that regardless of what actually causes depression, how about life? How about what we're not prepared to handle, and especially when it's unexpected, and we don't have a support system? And how about when we do have a support system, and something happens that we just emotionally are not prepared for, that we don't feel good about it? And depression is a normal part of living. And throughout all of history, there have been moments where people have gone through the loss of a loved one, the loss of their health, and they get depressed. Today, we just have a lot more reasons to be depressed. Quote, in other areas of life, the products we use, from computers to microwaves, improve year on year. But this is not the case with medicines, where this year's treatments may achieve blockbuster sales despite being less effective and less safe than yesterday's models. Okay, and finally, not only may antidepressants not attack the root cause of depression, they may also be dangerously and permanently altering brain function. So let's just get this right so it's not confusing. Depression is due to life. And no one has perfected that yet. We're all working on it. So it's completely normal for people to be depressed or lonely people to get depressed because they're lonely, or to be surrounded by people and still feel lonely or depressed. But it's not due to a brain chemical imbalance. But they're selling the drugs as if it were. And they're telling everyone it's a brain chemical imbalance. So we're going to give you a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. We're going to elevate your serotonin level. But you have no way of measuring my serotonin level. Can't be measured. That's correct. So you don't know by raising it, are you doing harm to me? That's correct. So I'm a human guinea pig, but you've marketed so perfectly. You've bowed down to the god of marketing and how to control people's buying habits, Edward Bernays. Yeah. And so we're all taking these stupid drugs that anyone with an IQ above 7 should realize, I forgot that's your doctor, should know is dangerous or not effective. So when you keep seeing people and you keep changing drugs and they are suicidal, you never think maybe the drugs you're giving them are causing this suicidal tendencies or ideation. Yep. And now we have evidence that these antidepressants could be the root cause of depression and actually causing a biochemical reality. Yeah. So there wasn't a biochemical reaction in the brain, but because you gave them an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety drug, now they have a brain chemical imbalance. You got it. Now it makes sense. Okay, hope people understand how important this is. Man, we should do away the entire field of psychiatry and include humanistic psychology to take its place. But that's not all Big Pharma does. There is no end to their capacity to manipulate and exploit to make a profit. The only thing that they should never have to worry about if you work in the pharmaceutical industry or Wall Street or Washington, D.C. is ever having a heart attack. The supposition is they had to have a heart to have an attack. This is from Martha Rosenberg. Big Pharma promises men endless youth with drugs that may cause blood clots, heart problems, and suicide. When was the last time your doctor said, I'm going to give you this drug, but it could also kill you? Recently, in an editorial in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, cited, quote, disease mongering of testosterone to men for conditions for which it is not approved. Increasingly, low libido, obesity, and age-related changes to the so-called low T or low testosterone. This spring, Martha Rosenberg interviewed the co-author of that scientific article, Thomas Pearls, a professor of medicine and director of the New England Centurion study at Boston Medical Center and Boston University School of Medicine. He defined disease mongering as, quote, inventing new broader definitions of a disease or even the invention of a disease in conjunction with widespread marketing to increase sales of specific drugs and therapies. Yeah, well, Isn't that just about every single drug advertised on television? Yes. So true instances of testosterone deficiency, according to the doctor, are, quote, rare. But massive marketing campaigns, he says, now claim that common middle-aged symptoms like lack of energy, well, maybe your diet and your energy drinks and your sugar has depleted your adrenal glands, and adrenaline is low. Maybe you have hypoglycemia. Maybe you have an underactive thyroid. There's your energy loss. And poor sleep. Well, eating late at night, working on a computer at night, going to bed stressed, there's your poor sleep. Poor libido. Where's the imagination gone? You want to have a strong libido? Think exotic thoughts. Remember, 99% of sex is in the mind. 1% is in the body. And don't we ever have that discussion? Never. So it's normal to have these things happen. So now the FDA and Health Canada warn of an increased risk of blood clots in the legs and lungs from testosterone therapy. Cardiac rhythm disturbances like atrial fibrillation and symptoms of coronary artery disease are seen in patients on the hormone therapy and even violent behavior, what's called roid rage, impulsiveness, and suicide. Studies suggest dormant cancer can become accelerated and activated by testosterone stimulation. So how likely is it that this man calling this disease mongering going to get out there? Well, last year, testosterone drugs sold $2 billion, so it's likely he isn't going to be heard, but he's not the first person. Let's go back to 1966. There was a book called Feminine Forever by Robert Wilson, a Wyeth-funded gynecologist who told women that they would be, quote, flabby, shrunken, dull-minded, and de-sexed unless they took hormone replacement therapy. Quote, no woman can be sure of escaping the horror of this living decay, he warned. And in 1946, Smith, Klein, and French add in psychosomatic medicine actually calls electric shock and estrogenic therapy, quote, fundamental measures for menopause. Yes, you heard me correct. In fact, just this morning when I was dictating to my editor some new information on a new book on women's health, which will be out later this year. It's over 1,000 pages. I want to make sure that this was in there, that your doctor was recommending for menopause electroconvulsive therapy and estrogenic therapy. As recently as 2000, high-budget white TV ads with the model Laura Hutton said menopause, quote, contributes to other age-related diseases. Really? Show me one. I did a study on menopause. We reversed all menopausal symptoms. I'd like to see your evidence. But unfortunately, hormone replacement therapy was considered the youth elixir, and it would help your memory and sight and tooth loss. It didn't. The truth was that hormones, synthetic hormone replacement, not only did not work as promoted, it caused the exact scourges it was supposed to prevent. A federal study found hormone replacement therapy increased the risk of breast cancer by 26%, heart attacks by 29%, stroke by 41%, and doubled the risk of blood clots. It also led to dementia and colorectal cancer. In a related study, hormone replacement therapy doubled the risk of dementia in women, and brains of older women given hormone replacement therapy actually shrunk the brain in a different government study. Women on hormone replacement therapy are more likely to lose their hearing, develop gallbladder disease, urinary incontinence, asthma, melanoma, and need joint replacement. That's according to two separate articles. There are greater risk of ovarian, endometrial, lung cancers, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Not only did hormone replacement therapy increase the risk of breast cancer, it made detecting the cancer more difficult. As early as 1995, an article in the Journal of Radiology said, quote, an increase in mammographic density, end quote, was demonstrated in most subjects of undergoing continuous combined hormone replacement therapy. By 2008, the hormone replacement therapy caused abnormal mammograms were so well defined, researchers warned, quote, this adverse effect on breast cancer detection should be incorporated into risk-benefit discussions with women considering even short-term combined hormone therapy. And the philosophical noun hormone replacement therapy's coffin came in 2006 when researchers announced that in the 1 year since women quit hormone replacement therapy, the incidence of breast cancer fell 7%. It fell 15% in women whose tumors were fed by estrogen. It was the first time breast cancer rates had even fallen significantly, reported the New York Times. It was the largest one-year drop, according to Dr. Peter Ravden of MD Anderson Cancer Center and the National Cancer Institute reported, quote, huge decline in breast cancer incidence the year women quit hormone replacement therapy. So, there you have it. Big Pharma wants the profits, even if it kills you. And finally, last week we all heard, it was all over the news, that they had their first death from measles in over 14 years. And it was really serious. No, it wasn't. And it was taking something out of its proper context. What happened was that the so-called death from measles was not true. Why? This simple. The news report started talking about the death of a woman in Washington, in the first since 2003. Well, someone in the United States had died of measles. Okay, one person. A woman was probably exposed to measles at a medical facility during an outbreak this spring. Many of the articles use this tragic incident to bemoan the falling vaccination rates and shame those who chose not to vaccinate. But the lesser report was that here's what went wrong in the discussion. This woman was being treated for a life-challenging condition with immune-suppressing drugs. And according to Washington State health officials, she already had been vaccinated for measles. So let's put this together in a proper context. How can anyone use this one death as a reason to chide people for not being vaccinated? Had the woman not been on the immune-suppressing meds, she would have likely had enough immunity to protect against the disease. But because her immune suppression, once the disease developed, she did not experience the characteristic measles rash. Instead, she developed pneumonia. The actual cause of the woman's illness was only revealed after she had been hospitalized at a second medical facility and died and underwent an autopsy. The cause of death was pneumonia secondary to measles, not the measles encephalitis that kills patients in many developing countries. So, a patient who is fully vaccinated against measles is given massive drugs that suppress her immune system, is exposed to measles in a medical facility, contracts the virus there because her immune system suppression, and no one realizes it because she never developed a rash and dies of a complication that is extremely rare anywhere. And now her death is being used as a cudgel to get more people to become vaccinated. There just doesn't seem any boundaries to how far the pro-vaccine people will go. And yet, not a word out of the 128,000 deaths in hospitals from FDA-approved drugs last year. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go down to Northern Virginia, where Ray McGovern is standing by. Ray served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst under seven presidential administrations, from John F. Kennedy's White House to that of George H.W. Bush. Among his duties was preparing the president's daily brief, which was a one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. Ray is also the author of many important articles and books, and he has a background, graduate in theology and philosophy from Fordham University, and also graduated from Harvard Business School, and a theology certificate from Georgetown University. His website is raymcgovern.com, and more writings of his can be found on consortiumnews.com. Nice to have you with us today, Ray.
Thank you, Gary.
There have been reports and some evidence that the U.S. and European Union and NATO may be planning to instill a coup or even instability in Greece to bring about a regime change. Whether this is because of Greece's defiance of the European Union demands or because of Greece's stance against European and U.S. sanctions on Russia is not known. The U.S. was involved in overthrowing a democratically elected Greek government back in the late 1980s, so there is a precedent for regime change here. And when Victoria Nuland visited Athens, she warned Greece about breaking sanctions against Russia. And back in April, Putin signed a trade agreement over natural gas with Greece's prime minister that would bring 4.2 billion euros to Greece. And Moscow has stated publicly that it views Greece as a sovereign state with a right to forge economic alliances in its own best interests. And Greece has a potential to be an energy hub to transport gas to Central Asia via Turkish stream gas pipeline that Russia and the Turkey government partnered on. What we are witnessing in this scenario is that if a country is a member of the European Union, its true sovereignty is hampered by the rulings of the more economically powerful members of this, such as Germany and France. In addition, Russia, in retaliation to Western sanctions, has banned the import of Western foods and would therefore consider lifting the ban on Greece, and Hungary and Cyprus, who are building stronger relations with Russia. So I'd like you to tell us your assessment of where Greece now stands in the geopolitical turmoil of the Eurozone and with respect to the standoff in Ukraine and U.S. aggressions against Russia.
Well, Gary, this is really a big deal, this whole referendum where the Greeks said no, and we mean it. It seems to have been relatively new and unexpected to the European bureaucrats, the people who run the banks and run the economies there. Ironically, Gary, it seems to be a matter of hubris, the old Greek flaw, which was the downfall of all the Greek tragic heroes, because the stunned and the furious reaction by European leaders, it's probably explained largely because they didn't realize what they're dealing with. These new Greek leaders are of a type that they haven't seen, that the Europeans haven't seen for years. I mean, they were democratically elected, and now, of course, they've been given extra pizzazz by the referendum, and they won't be as easily intimidated. In other words, Tsipras, the leader, and Varoufakis, the fellow who just resigned as economic czar, they meant what they said. And what that means, of course, is that all these bullying tactics, cutting off bank financing and threatening general chaos and pushing the current government in Athens pretty much out of office if they had their druthers, well, that's not going to work. That's not going to work. It's not working, and they're going to have to come to some sort of accommodation or else they lose all their money. And, of course, money speaks, and money is at the bottom of all this. The other thing is that, the European Union, when it comes to its senses, as Paul Krugman has suggested, should sort of treat this as a wake-up call and say, look, if we want to get any money back, we're going to have to trim our sails. The IMF itself has said that this austerity package we forced on the Greeks is not working. It's making it worse for the Greeks and everybody else. So let's go back to the table, see if we can make some sense here, and let's see if we can work with this. Now, the threat that some people are mentioning, we used to call it overthrowing governments in my day. Now we call it regime change. Well, it's not going to work anymore. The Greeks labored under governments caused by regime change, or in those days, overthrowing their democratic elected governments, between 1967 and 74. That was an incredibly traumatic time for all Greeks who were alive at the time, and it's not going to happen again. Another reason why it's not going to happen is that, the military leaders, get this, Gary, a lot of them are socialists, right? A lot of them are very progressive, and they're not going to be able to be enlisted, no matter how much money is spread around by the British and American intelligence. They're not going to be enlisted this time to overthrow the government or even make more gentle regime change. Okay. Another factor here, which really needs to be mentioned up front, is that the Greeks really dislike the Germans, and they have a long history of having adequate reason to dislike them. The history books are full of massacres like the one in Crete during World War II. And they're taught, these people are really not to be trusted, and they're going to take advantage of us. And if further proof were needed, there's a steady flow of a very wealthy German tourists on the beaches of Greece. And, of course, they do all kinds of outlandish things there, like having some sex on the beaches and all that kind of thing. They really turn the Greeks off, and this is an element here. And it adds to the support that the government has in facing into this quarrel, and giving it even more support than it would ordinarily have.
I want to shift gears and go to Russia and Ukraine. We have heard virtually nothing from any of the major media, including much of the alternative media, concerning how the United States, behind the scenes, was instrumental in the Ukrainian coup, and even members of Congress are reticent about admitting unconsciously that Nazis are playing a role in the Ukraine. And this was the House's unanimous vote to bar U.S. financial military assistance to one of the Ukraine government's battalions, the Azov, due to its Nazi ties. In fact, earlier, Ukraine's interior minister stated that this was the unit the U.S. military advisors were being sent to train. And yet these have been the government's stormtroopers that have targeted Russians living in eastern Ukraine. And our mainstream media will not touch this. They will not tell the truth about this. They're called volunteers. But there is good evidence that the Nazi roots, or at least a Nazi or fascist ideology, is much more deeply rooted in Kiev regime than the U.S. is supporting. What is your view now on how Ukraine, irrespective of its political ideology, is being manipulated and molded by the United States and its allies, and for what ultimate purpose is the United States military posturing against Russia?
Well, you put out a very good point that has not been made, as you say, in mainstream media. My colleague, Robert Perry of ConsortiumNews.com, did an article yesterday titled "Ukraine Merges Nazis and Islamists." Now, you have to know what an incredibly cautious and professional investigative journalist Bob Perry is before you will even read an article like that. But here it is, and it quotes the New York Times. It quotes the New York Times as saying, yeah, the Azov Brigade and the right sector and other people who are unabashedly wearing Nazi insignia, including the swastika and other signs, and actually have been photographed at their meetings, not only with those insignia, but with the Confederate flag of the Confederate States of America. Now, they are actually appearing now in the New York Times, belatedly, but better late than never. And they're also quoted as saying, well, you know, some of these Islamists, you know, they could be enlisted to, they hate Russians, and they can, you know, if you hate Russians and you have to bring some weapons with you, welcome to the game. So it's beginning to be exposed, at least in alternative media, and it's a very big part of this whole thing. What people, you know, I'm amazed, Gary. I was talking at a Pax Christi meeting of very progressive Catholics, and we had some lecturers there. And after me came on this lecturer from a local university here in Washington, and she said, you know, one of the things I'm so proud of is my son came back from Sunday school, and he had this poster that he made, and it said, Mr. Putin, have you not heard, thou shalt not kill? And I looked at her, and I looked at my progressive colleagues, and everyone was sort of nodding, oh, isn't that great? So I raised my hands, well, what is the illusion here? And she said, well, Crimea, his aggression against Crimea. I said, well, how many people get killed there? Oh, hundreds, thousands probably. I said, would you believe none? Would you believe zero? She said, well, I can't believe it. Well, you know, you're entitled to your opinion, but not entitled to your own facts. You ought to go to the responsible reportage. It was a bloodless thing. It was very craftily done, and that's what rankles very much in terms of Washington. They didn't see it coming. So what I'm saying here is that for most Americans, the story on Ukraine starts with Russian aggression. Now, no Americans know that under an international treaty with Ukraine, Russia had the ability, had the right to station 30,000 troops in Crimea. 30,000, count them. They didn't need 30,000 to swiftly take over the government offices right after the coup in Kiev. Now, the coup in Kiev was more than a month before. What I pointed out in a recent letter to the editor in the Washington Post, which is really, I get in the Washington Post once every 10 years, Gary, McCain had written an article in their Outlook section Sunday, and he had said, you know, what Putin did was seize Ukraine without provocation. And you know, so I wrote, well, you know, how about the coup? How about the coup on the 22nd of February? And I said, wasn't that provocation enough? And, you know, what people don't realize is that when the Post reports, they start on the 23rd of February. And I quoted back to the Post an article that was titled, Putin had early plan to annex Crimea. And this report described a secret meeting, in quotes, Mr. Putin had on February 23, during which, quote, Russia decided it would take the Crimea Peninsula, end quote. And I pointed out in my letter, you know, you forgot to mention that there was a coup d'etat the previous day that put in a pro-American, pro-European putsch government named ahead of time by Victoria Nuland, our Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, and that this coup was called by, actually this fellow is a pretty good guy, George Friedman, who's a widely respected fellow. He heads up the think tank Stratfor. He's explained the putsch on February 22nd, so the coup. He described it as, quote, the most blatant coup in history, end quote. Why? Well, because 2.5 weeks before the coup, an intercepted telephone conversation between Victoria Nuland, our Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, and our ambassador in Kiev, talked about who would be the new leaders and named Yats, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, to be the new prime minister. That was 2.5 weeks before posted on YouTube, okay? So this was the most blatant coup in history, but very, very few Americans know.
You're right, Ray. We're out of time. Mm-hmm. We look forward to another conversation. Ray McGovern, Consortium News. Get caught up on it. And the takeaway message is, The American media refuses to do the investigative reporting, which it has the resources and responsibility to do, to tell us the truth that the United States, with allies, orchestrated the coup that he's referring to in Kyiv, in the Ukraine, and Russia responded to it. And we only focused upon the response because we would put NATO troops and NATO weapons right up on their border. And you can see the private military-industrial complex's fingerprints are all over this. The neocons are all over this. But the average American is not aware of any of this. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.